أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
Assalamu alaikum. Hello. Welcome to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. I am your host, Bill Whitehouse, and my Sufi friends call me Anab. I have been traveling sometimes more quickly and sometimes much more slowly on the Sufi path for over 40 years. I am not a Sufi sheikh, but I would like to use the contents of this podcast as a means of sharing with you some thoughts, ideas, possibilities, values, and principles concerning the Sufi spiritual way. Each edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will feature various selections concerning poetry, essays, readings from traditional sources, and reflections that give expression to different dimensions of the Sufi path. In addition, there also will be several musical interludes included that offer a change of pace of sorts. So relax, melt into the comfort of your chair, close your eyes, and permit me to take you on an excursion through some of the unrestricted regions of the Sufi spiritual path.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful.
والليل إذا يغشى والنهار إذا تجلى وما خلق الذكر والأنثى إن سعيكم لشتى فأما من أعطى واتقى وصدق بالحسنى فسنيسره لليسرى وَأَمَّا مَنْ بَخِلَ وَاسْتَغْنَى وَكَذَّبَ بِالْحُسْنَى فَسَنُيَسِّرُهُ لِلْعُسْرَى وَمَا يُغْنِي عَنْهُ مَالُهُ إِذَا تَرَدَّى.
By the night enshrouding and the day resplendent, and him who hath created male and female, lo, your effort is dispersed toward diverse ends. As for him who giveth and is dutiful toward Allah and believeth in goodness, surely we will ease his way unto the state of ease. But as for him who hoardeth and deemeth himself independent and disbelieveth in goodness, surely we will ease his way unto adversity. His riches will not save him when he perisheth.
علينا للهدى وإن لنا للآخرة والأولى فأنذرتكم نارا تلظى لا يصلاها إلا الأشقى الذي كذب وتولى وسيجنبها الأتقى الذي يؤتي ماله يتزكى وما لأحد عنده من نعمة تجزى إلا ابتغاء وجه ربه الأعلى ولسوف يرضى.
Lo, ours it is to give the guidance, and lo, unto us belong the latter portion and the former. Therefore, have I warned you of the flaming fire, which only the most wretched must endure? He who denieth and turneth away, far removed from it will be the righteous, who giveth his wealth that he may grow in goodness. And none hath with him any favor for reward, except as seeking to fulfill the purpose of his Lord Most High. He verily will be content.
The foregoing excerpt from the Quran was Surah 92, The Night, and was recited by Qari Wahid Zafar Qasmi. Some people take exception with the appearance of the idea of fire that occurs in the Quran, such as, for example, in Surah 92, which was just recited, and feel like God is threatening human beings with a do this or else sort of ultimatum. Notwithstanding the fact that the significance and meaning of the symbolism of fire have been filtered through the ignorance of various kinds of theologies and mythologies concerning the nature of certain possibilities in the afterlife, perhaps one should take pause to reflect on the situation. From the perspective of the Sufis, fire can give expression to, among other possibilities, a process of purification. We have a decision to make. We can choose to engage the process of purification in this life, or that process will be engaged in the life to come. But in either case, the necessity for purification cannot be avoided, any more than one can avoid the realities of death. It is part and parcel of the potentials inherent in human existence. God is not threatening human beings with a condition of fire that might be inflicted in the afterlife. God is giving clear warning about the nature of cause and effect. As Surah 92 points out, if we choose to share what has been given to us with others, as well as struggle against evil and accept the best of what is being offered to us, then our way will be made easy and facilitated. On the other hand, if we choose to reject the best of what is being offered to us by divinity, as well as consider ourselves as being beyond the need for divine assistance, and in addition we turn our backs on those who are in need or we seek to hurt them, then God will facilitate our slide towards an end fraught with difficulty. The fire that is being alluded to is not a punishment any more than the problems which follow from falling off a cliff are a form of punishment with respect to the individual who chooses to ignore the information provided by the clearly worded signs that are posted near the cliff. It is cause and effect. The fire, whatever its nature might be, conveys something of the experiential flavor that a person might experience when he or she becomes aware of how various life choices have led one away from the truths concerning one's relationship with divinity and away from truths concerning one's own essential self. Among other possibilities, one might burn with regret when one comes to understand the true status of one's choices in relation to the opportunities that have been lost through the pursuit of delusional ends. Moreover, an individual might burn with shame, embarrassment, and grief when one comes to grasp the magnitude of the mistakes that have been made by virtue of the choices a person has made for himself or herself in the present life. If one is unwilling to learn about the cause and effect nature of existential principles in this life, then one will have the opportunity to learn about such principles in the life to come. God is not punishing us, but rather we have imposed suffering upon ourselves due to our own negligence concerning the warnings that were given about the dangers associated with certain kinds of choices. However one might choose, God will help facilitate the direction in which one's choices take one. Yet God warns us about the situation and asks human beings to reflect on the properties of the direction to which their choices are being assisted to flow. God willing, my intention is to release the Sufi Study Circle podcast between sunset on Thursday evening and sunset on Friday. I have given myself 24 degrees of freedom with respect to the time of release because life often has a way of interfering with schedules that are wound too tight. Friday is an auspicious day for Islam, as well as Tasawwuf, or the Sufi mystical path. For instance, Thursday evening, or Friday morning in lunar terms, is a time when Sufi groups assemble in different localities around the world. Moreover, Friday is a day when Muslims gather for the midday prayer and a khutbah or sermon is given prior to those prayers. I have given the title Friday Thoughts to this section of the Sufi Study Circle podcast. Friday Thoughts does not follow the format of a khutbah, and yet, like a khutbah, it seeks to give expression to an array of ideas, values, and principles that are meant to be shared with those who are listening. Words that are intended to echo in the hearts, souls, and beings of attendees throughout the rest of the day, if not the following week and perhaps beyond. The themes of Friday Thoughts will be varied. However, God willing, they will reflect a Sufi perspective. The title of this week's edition of Friday Thoughts is Everest. I came away from my viewing of the recently released movie Everest with a lot of mixed emotions and even more questions. On one level, the movie provided a fairly good overview of the rather expensive, complex, and often quite dangerous set of procedures that are entailed by a climb of Everest, especially for those people who are not veteran climbers and who are paying quite a lot of money, $65,000 or more, to be guided to the top of the mountain. Over the years, there have been more than 4,000 people who successfully made the ascent. Today, approximately 90% of the would-be Everest adventurers are at best amateur climbers, and some of them do not even possess the most basic of climbing skills. Thus the need for experienced climbers or tour guides who can assist them on the journey. Some people might describe the foregoing combination of inexperience, lack of climbing skill, and profit-driven guides as constituting an accident waiting to happen. On May 11, 1996, such an accident did happen. Whether or not one is a veteran climber, nevertheless, as is pointed out in the film, quote, human beings aren't built to function at the cruising altitude of a 747 Boeing jet, end of quote. Many things can go wrong at high altitudes in conjunction with both the experienced as well as the inexperienced. For example, one can acquire a high altitude cough. This is brought about by an accelerated rate of respiration of cold air at high altitudes. The foregoing conditions can dry out the lining of the lungs. This can lead to the development of cracks in the lining of the lungs that in turn lead to coughs that can be strong enough to crack a person's ribs. In addition, there is also the possibility of developing high-altitude cerebral and/or pulmonary edema. These conditions can be generated by a body's response to living at high altitudes, and in the process, pressure is created in the lungs and the brain by the buildup of an excess of fluids. Furthermore, operating at high altitudes means one does not have access to as much oxygen as is normally the case. This can lead to a condition known as hypoxia, in which a person is prone to making poor judgments about how to deal with any given situation that presents itself while engaged in the climbing process. Aside from the physiological problems that can accompany life at high altitudes, there are also other sources of danger during any climb of Everest. For instance, on the Nepal side of Mount Everest, the Khumbu Icefall spreads out at an altitude of around 18,000 feet and constitutes one of the most dangerous obstacles for anyone who approaches the summit through the South Col, the route selected by the tour guide for the group of individuals that is being followed during the course of the Everest movie. There are other routes to the summit of Mount Everest that do not entail going through the icefall. However, those routes entail hazards of their own, and such routes also present technical challenges that would overwhelm the climbing abilities of many tourists. The contents of the ice fall are constantly on the move, about 3 to 4 feet per day, and quite unpredictably can open up deep crevices at the most inopportune times. As well, there are ice towers known as seracs which can collapse without warning, sending showers of ice down the ice fall, with some of these falling pieces being the size of a house. In addition, there is the element of weather. The best time to climb Mount Everest is in the spring, roughly from April to May. However, even during the best climbing season, the weather can be quite unpredictable. Being caught in an unanticipated blizzard at 28,000 feet does not always turn out well. There is no need for me to issue a spoiler alert in relation to the movie when I say that 8 people died during the May 11, 1996 climbing tragedy. Those events have been written about by a variety of authors, including John Krakauer and Anatoly Bukriev, who are both first-hand witnesses to the tragedy. John Krakauer wrote an article about the tragedy first for Outside magazine and then later on in his book Into Thin Air. Bukriev wrote his own version of the tragic events in his book The Climb, Tragic Ambitions on Everest. In a 2015 interview, Krakauer indicates that, despite its being a childhood dream, nevertheless, climbing Mount Everest was perhaps the biggest mistake of his life. He still suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder in connection with the tragedy, and some of the stress disorder is due to the ongoing agony he feels with respect to mistakes he made and whether or not he might have done more to help out some of the climbers as the tragedy unfolded. He states that if he had the opportunity to remake the earlier choice, he would not have joined the expedition to climb Everest. Moreover, while he has never been one to say that people shouldn't try crazy things, he indicates that Mount Everest is a crazy thing of a completely different order. A little over a year later, on Christmas Day 1997, Anatoly Bukriev was involved in another climbing tragedy while climbing Annapurna in the Himalayas. He, along with several companions, were caught in an avalanche at approximately 19,500 feet. In addition to the 8 individuals who died in the aforementioned 1996 incident, 7 other people died during the 1996 Everest climbing season. The total of 15 deaths makes 1996 the most fatal Mount Everest climbing season on record, at least it was up until that point. The biggest tragedy involving Mount Everest climbers was due to the April 25th Nepalese earthquake that occurred earlier this year. The earthquake set in motion a devastating icefall that ripped through a base camp that had been set up at 17,500 feet, preventing more than 42 teams, totaling some 200 climbers who were getting ready to ascend the mountain, from being able to descend to safety following the avalanche. 17 of the trapped climbers died, 60 others were injured with varying degrees of severity. A separate avalanche the previous year led to the death of 16 Sherpa porters, the real workhorses of any climbing expedition. The tragedy led to the cancellation of the 2014 climbing season amidst protests concerning the failure of the government to take adequate steps to properly regulate the climbing industry, an industry that, along with other tourist attractions, had been bringing in about $1 billion a year to the Nepalese economy. Some 240 people have died attempting to climb Mount Everest. For some, the death toll is part of the mystique surrounding the lure of the mountain. The foregoing information establishes some of the brutal facts concerning Mount Everest. Then, of course, there is the human dimension of things, and this is the portion of the movie Everest that left me with a great many conflicted emotions and, as well, a great many questions. At one point during the movie, and prior to the point where the real business of the final ascent begins, John Krakauer, a journalist, asks the individuals in his group why they want to climb Everest. Initially, they all begin with a mock group chorus of "Because it is there," which was first uttered by George Mallory in a 1924 interview with the New York Times when he was asked the same sort of question. Mallory was involved in 3 expeditions of Mount Everest. The first climb in 1921 was a failure, while a second climb ended in tragedy when 9 of the Sherpa porters accompanying the expedition were killed in an avalanche. Mallory mounted a third attempt to scale Mount Everest in 1924 but lost his life during the climb. He was last seen heading for the summit with a climbing companion, Arthur Irvine. His frozen body was found in 1999. No one knows whether or not Mallory ever realized his goal of reaching the top of Mount Everest. Following their raucous chorus of Because It's There, some of the 1996 group of individuals being interviewed by John Krakauer provided their own take on the question of why they were climbing Mount Everest. Yasuko Namba indicated that she had been able to climb 6 of the 7 summits, and climbing Mount Everest would complete the task of ascending the tallest mountains present on each of the 7 continents, thus becoming the second Japanese woman to achieve the feat. Doug Hansen, an occasional carpenter and postman, was able to join the expedition because Rob Hall, the head of Adventure Consultants, had a soft spot for Doug and gave him a steep discount on the usual fee that is charged to participate in such an expedition. When prompted by some who were present and knew a little about Doug's life to speak about the children as the reason why he wanted to climb Mount Everest, Doug Hansen indicated that he sometimes spoke to school children and wanted to encourage them to seek to realize their goals, and consequently he wanted to serve as a role model of sorts, to show that even ordinary people can dream and aspire to achieve things that might not seem possible to others. And since the challenge of Everest was there, he felt it would be wrong not to try. Both Yasuko Namba and Doug Hansen realized their respective ambitions in 1996. They also both lost their lives during that process of realization. Beck Withers, who to a degree survived the 1996 tragedy but nearly froze to death, eventually losing both hands and part of his nose, apparently once said to Doug Hansen that the reason why he climbed mountains and took adventure trips is because when he wasn't involved in such activities, a little black cloud seemed to follow him around in normal life, a black cloud that would only dissipate during such adventures. Somewhat perplexingly, both Beck Withers and Yasuko Namba were freezing to death on a part of the trail to which a number of other climbers were descending. Although Beck Withers, at least according to the movie version, indicated to the individuals passing by that he was holding his position in accordance with instructions that he had been given by Rob Hall and was operating in accordance with his understanding that Rob would be back for him and therefore Beck should stay put, it seems odd that none of those passing him by took it upon themselves to insist that Beck Withers join them as they descended towards the nearest camp. To be sure, Beck was having trouble with his vision, and therefore he probably would have needed plenty of assistance in making the rest of the descent to the camp. Yet, a number of individuals apparently accepted at face value the idea that a person who was in obvious physical distress and visually disabled during blizzard conditions on the side of Mount Everest should have been permitted to continue to lie on the ground and freeze while waiting for Godot. Nearing death, the movie indicates that visions of his wife and child came to him and were urging Beck Withers to get up. This seemed to be the necessary stimulus that induced him to awaken from his sleep of death, make his way to his feet, and stagger off towards the camp. Despite his visual disability, Beck Withers somehow made it back to camp under his own steam. If he had been assisted earlier on by one or more of the people who had been passing him by, he might have been able to save his hands and nose. Yasuko Namba also was located in the same vicinity as where Beck Withers was freezing to death. She too was freezing to death, and if one or more of the descending passers-by had assisted her, there are indications that she might not have died. When Mrs. Withers received word that her husband was actually alive and not dead, as people thought, she demonstrated just what a peach she was, her first name was Peach, by moving those who do not like being moved, i.e. people in power. More specifically, she applied pressure and arranged for a helicopter to make an extremely dangerous flight into the high-altitude camp where her husband was staying and rescue him, because he would not have been able to make the journey across the Khumbu icefall that would be encountered when descending Mount Everest from the base camp he was at. In part, Beck Weathers bears some of the responsibility for what happened to him. For example, he failed to take into consideration, or prior to the expedition even ask anyone about, what effect high altitude conditions might have on a surgical procedure that had been performed on his eyes the previous year. Moreover, somewhat stubbornly, he kept telling people who were passing by that he was okay, when this is obviously not the case. In addition, perhaps he should have searched for activities that were less risky as a strategy for chasing away the black cloud that seemed to be following him around in the midst of his everyday activities. In fact, maybe he should have journeyed into the heart of the inner darkness within him that was generating the blackness that had been stalking him. But this might have required him to work on himself rather than become distracted through this or that adventure. On the other hand, Beck Weathers' response to the black cloud that was following him around in the midst of everyday life resonates with a story that is found in several traditional sources. The story has many variants. Essentially, the story indicates that a person runs into the angel of death in a market in Baghdad, and the angel gives the individual a strange look. The individual is convinced that death will be coming for him soon in Baghdad, and therefore he arranges for a speedy horse to take him to Samarra, where he believes he will be safe. But once again, he comes face to face with the angel of death. Curious about the incident in the Baghdad market, the individual asks the angel about the strange look that had been given by the angel during that encounter. The angel replies that he had an appointment with the man in Samarra, and therefore wondered what the man was doing in Baghdad. Sometimes the things we do to avoid what is bothering us have a way of haunting us, and sooner or later, inducing us to have to deal with the issues from which one was running away or trying to escape at the outset. The black cloud that Beck Weathers thought he was escaping by going on the Everest expedition reasserted itself in a different way. One of the beautiful names of Allah is Ar-Razak, the source for and means through which all sustenance and provisions of creation are realized. God is the one who bestows providence for each life, and Rizq constitutes the provisions that have been set forth for every individual by Ar-Razak. All of life is a series of Rizq transactions. There is a right way and a wrong way of pursuing and engaging such transactions. Beck Weathers did not have an appointment with death on May 11, 1996. He did, however, have an appointment with the black cloud that had been pursuing him. Despite the role that Beck Weathers might have played in helping to bring about his personal tragedy on the slopes of Mount Everest, I am still dumbstruck by how a number of people could pass him by and accept his answer that he was okay and leave him in conditions that were a clear and present danger to him. Of course, the individuals who passed him by as they were descending the mountain might themselves have been dealing with any number of traumatic experiences, plus possibly suffering from hypoxia and the problematic effects of exposure on mental activity. But still, the question remains with me. Why was he left on the side of the mountain? Why didn't one or more of the descending passerbys insist on taking Beck Weathers with them? Another facet of the tragedy was the relationship between Rob Hall, who was a veteran climber, and Doug Hansen, a Yadaman or Everyman, who was seeking to inspire young people to chase their dreams and not let themselves be limited by what other people think might be possible. Because Rob Hall had a soft spot for Doug and believed in what Doug was trying to do as just a regular guy, Rob made a decision that led to a tragic conclusion for both himself and for Doug. Rob Hall was the first non-Sherpa to climb Mount Everest 5 times. He also was someone who believed in not only getting his clients to the top of Everest, but as well to get them down safely. His aforementioned tragic decision was caught up in the ascent aspect of things and failed to properly assess the dangers associated with a safe descent. In fact, during the movie, Scott Fisher, who was associated with a rival expedition group, Mountain Madness, indirectly criticized Rob Hall's modus operandi of looking after his charges like a mother hen. Fisher said he believed that if people had to have their hand held, then they shouldn't be on the mountain. He had a point. Yet Scott Fisher was someone who, at least in the movie version of things, appeared to have overestimated his own ability to withstand what Mother Nature could throw at him, and that excessive self-confidence cost him his life on the fateful 1996 expedition, just as Rob Hill's decision to woo against his better judgment would put himself and his charge, Doug Hansen, at grave risk. Doug Hansen had been straggling behind the rest of the group because he was suffering from high-altitude cough, and therefore he was having breathing problems. Rob Hill had set a 2 p.m. deadline for the cessation of all ascent activity, and with the exception of Beck Weathers, who had been left below because he was experiencing vision problems, and Doug Hansen, who was having breathing problems and therefore was well behind the others, everyone in the combined expedition involving adventure consultants and mountain madness made a successful ascent of Mount Everest by the 2 p.m. deadline that had been set. Everyone was beginning to start the descent down the mountain when Rob Hall, who was descending from the summit with the others who had made it to the top, reached Doug Hansen. The latter individual was still trying to struggle towards the summit. Rob told Doug that he was sorry, but they had to descend the mountain. Doug pleaded with Rob to be permitted to go on. He argued that he was close to the summit and that he would never get this chance again. Somewhere in his mind, Rob made a series of calculations about the risks associated with continuing to the summit under such conditions, and apparently felt that perhaps they still might be able to pull it off. So despite some misgivings, he relented and began to accompany Doug back up towards the summit. The decision might have turned out okay if the inexplicable and the unpredictable had not decided to push their circumstances in a tragic direction. The inexplicable came in the form of missing tanks of oxygen that were supposed to have been deposited at key locations through which the expedition would ascend and descend, but for reasons that are unknown, the bottles, at least ones full of oxygen, were not present. Did someone not properly do an assigned job, or did someone who was not entitled to do so use the contents of those bottles for their own needs? The latter possibility is distasteful, but there were indications in the movie that some climbers might have felt they were entitled to a precious commodity that was meant for someone else. For example, at one point, Rob Hill tried to arrange a meeting among the leaders of the different climbing expeditions to try to resolve some of the problems that were causing delays and, as a result, exposing people to unnecessary risk. One of the parties in the meeting objected to the proceedings. They indicated that nobody had the right to tell them when and where they could climb, and then stormed out of the meeting. Such arrogance is often associated with a sense of entitlement. Conceivably, someone on the mountain at the time of the tragedy might have filtered their decisions through such an orientation of arrogance and sense of entitlement, and as a result came upon the bottles of oxygen, knowing that someone else had arranged for the bottles to be placed at a certain location, and nevertheless made use of the bottles to satisfy their own needs. Because of the respiratory problems being experienced by Doug Hansen, he was in desperate need of oxygen. Although Doug had enough to reach the summit, he did not have enough for the descent, and the bottles of oxygen to which Rob was expecting to have access during that process of descent were not available. Presumably, when making his calculations about whether or not to permit Doug to proceed to the summit, Rob had assumed that there would be enough oxygen available when needed. His assumption was not warranted, and surely part of any process of risk assessment is to make considered judgments about the possibility that the assumptions on which one's assessment rests are properly vetted. Another dimension of the aforementioned element of the inexplicable involved certain climbing ropes that were supposed to have been tied and ready for use. Those ropes were to play a crucial role in helping to make the ascent during a certain stage of the climb. Unfortunately, the ropes were found in an untied condition. Some of them seemed to be missing as well. No answer is given as to what caused the foregoing problem. However, its presence led to a considerable delay and loss of precious time while trying to make the final ascent to the summit, a factor that put the ascent activities behind schedule and consequently affected the risks associated with Rob Hill's subsequent decision to permit Doug Hansen to make an attempt to ascend to the summit despite being on the wrong side of the 2 p.m. deadline. The unpredictable came in the form of a severe blizzard that had hit Mount Everest during the process of descent, not once but twice. Rob Hill survived the first go-around of the blizzard, but Doug Hansen was not able to survive that initial encounter, and without oxygen and protection, Rob Hill succumbed when he was forced to try to weather the storm when it assaulted the mountain a second time before help could reach him. Not much mention is made in the movie about the circumstances of the death of the three members of the Indian-Tibetan Border Police who were killed during the same May 11, 1996 tragedy. Their names were Dorje Morup, Saewang Palgir, and Saewang Samania, and presumably they were killed in the line of duty. There are many ways of parsing the Everest tragedy of May 11, 1996. Some people who died were trying to earn a living while engaging in an inherently risky enterprise, and in the end they were consumed by that risk. Other individuals lost their lives while pursuing their dreams. Every dream has both an upside and a downside, and sometimes both the downside and the upside are blended together in a way in which one realizes one dreams and dies in the process. We all make decisions concerning what we will do in order to, among other things, put food on the table, a roof over the heads of one's family members, and clothes on their backs. We all make decisions concerning our dreams and how important these dreams are to us. However, questions can be raised about whether or not the way one has decided to earn a living is what one should be doing with one's life, or whether one is going about engaging whatever that career choice might be in the right way. Similarly, questions can be raised about whether or not one should think about pursuing dreams other than those that currently motivate us, or whether or not we should be pursuing those dreams in a different manner or with a different orientation. The $65,000 cost associated with a guided ascent of Mount Everest could treat a lot of people. It is nice to have discretionary income, but at some point one has to ask oneself what is more important: using that discretionary income to serve the interest of the ego, and is climbing Mount Everest anything but an ego trip, or using such discretionary income to attend to people who are in need of our assistance? In many ways, one can't help but wonder if spending one's discretionary income on oneself rather than others is somewhat reminiscent of the manner in which a number of people who were descending Everest on 11th of May 1996 went past the disabled, freezing Beck Weathers without actually doing anything of a substantial nature to assist him. And asking if he was all right was just not enough. Discretionary income is not only caught up in money, but as well in the way one spends one's time, talents, and intentions. These are all risk transactions, just as there are right and wrong ways to acquire what is in our risk or divine provision. So, too, there are right and wrong ways to dispense the provisions of such riz. Now, some of the aforementioned $65,000 does undoubtedly reach some who are in need. After all, part of that money will be paid to various levels of government, as well as be spent among local shops and in the hiring of porters. Nevertheless, a great deal of that money goes to the experts who are operating the adventure tours up and down Mount Everest. Furthermore, I wonder how many of those climbing experts would be willing to risk their lives on the slopes of Mount Everest if they were receiving what the Sherpa porters were paid for their services. Moreover, there is a tremendous amount of waste materials and environmental degradation ensuing from such expeditions. While the movie showed Rob Hill picking up a few pieces of trash, the fact of the matter is there are tons of trash that remain spread across the mountain. Indeed, the pollution has become so rampant that many people pick up bacterial infections that cause diarrhea by using the snow that is found in the vicinity of the various camps for drinking and cooking. Of course, some might say that pursuing such dreams is to do precisely what God wishes from us, that, for example, by climbing Mount Everest, such individuals are fulfilling, at least in part, their destiny. However, like Rob Hill, when calculating the trip to the summit of one's dreams, we are all making risk assessments concerning the viability and value of such aspirations. Moreover, like Rob Hill, and this is true no matter how well-intentioned we might believe ourselves to be, We all run the risk of making assumptions about such circumstances that might turn out not to be correct. That is, we might assume reality be one way, when in point of fact, and quite tragically, it turns out to be something quite other than what our assumptions predict due to the confluence of a perfect storm involving faulty assumptions, inexplicable happenings, and unpredictable circumstances that in the end lead to tragic results. There is no aspect of life that is free of risk. Moreover, sooner or later, we will all lose our lives through the mediated agency of one or more of the risks that are impacting our lives. The question one must ask oneself is what choices will constitute the best way to engage the risks associated with life. What dream is one willing to die for? Not kill for, but die for, in order to pursue such dreams amidst the inherent risks of life. The Sufis have always had a very direct answer to the foregoing question. One way of summing it up is to cite an ayat of the Quran, namely Surah 6, verse 162, quote, "Say, surely my prayer and my service of sacrifice, my life and my death, are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds," end of quote. From the Sufi perspective, if one is pursuing dreams or engaging in work or running risks for reasons other than in the service of God, then there is a problem with such dreams, works, and risks. From the flowing plains of Kansas to the mountains of Colorado, from the lakes of Minnesota to the bayous of Louisiana, from the Everglades of Florida to the rocky coasts of Maine, you are listening to the Sufi Reflections Podcast. The foregoing instance of podcast identification has a little history to it. A young man by the name of Al used to live next door, and he played that rendition for me. Al was a friendly young man who had some mental challenges, but he loved playing the bagpipes and did so in various parades in and around the Bangor area. One day I asked him if he would play Amazing Grace so that I could record it and put it on my podcast. He agreed, and you just heard the result. Thank you, Al. Poetry is a form of communication that, when done well, seeps into one's mind, heart, and soul, resonating with one's being long after the spoken words have evaporated into the vastness of space. Yet every poem is vulnerable to the possibility of being distorted by the emotional and conceptual filters through which it is received. Moreover, although the foregoing vulnerability is present even when a poem is not translated from another language, the presence of translation opens up the possibility of considerable distortion entering into the way in which the underlying sense of a poem is engaged. Poetry is often filled with allusions, nuances, subtexts, idioms, similes, metaphors, and wordplay that don't necessarily remain intact when revealed within the context of another language. Just as the Quran cannot be reduced to how a given individual translates its meanings, so too Sufi poetry often does not travel intact from one language to another. Thus, for example, what was actually intended in a given passage of Rumi's original text might or might not be captured accurately, partially or wholly, by the way in which a given individual translates such a passage. Every edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast will contain poetry that is attributed to this or that Sufi poet. Usually such poetry will give expression to someone's translation of an original text that is written in a language other than English. Rather than trying to claim that, for instance, Rumi meant this or that in a given passage of poetry, especially one that is translated, one might fare better if one did not consider such a passage of poetry as necessarily constituting an authoritative representation of what a given poet, for instance Rumi, believed or understood or meant by such a passage. Instead, take the poetry as an opportunity to enter into a process of critical reflection and exploration concerning oneself and one's own relationship with divinity. Something is true not because someone, Rumi or anyone else, said it. Something is true because it reflects the way things are in some given context or on some given level of being. And poets are often held in esteem because they were able, by the grace of God, to reflect some dimension of that truth in an artful manner. The Sufi poets are leaving behind remnants in their words that are rooted in the phenomenology of a spiritual journey that seeks to travel in the direction of a truth that transcends all words. Use poetry as a point of disembarkation of sorts concerning such a journey. Let the words of a poem induce one to search for the truth, to embrace those words as reminders, filtered though they might be by the perspective of a translator or a listener, that there is a truth for which to search, and that there exists a reality that is waiting to be realized in one's life according to one's spiritual capacity and God's grace. The following poem is taken from the book A Sufi Saint of the 20th Century, Sheikh Ahmed al-Alawi. It is entitled The Present Reality. The summoner unto God's nearness hath called to them, Lo, I am with you. For wheresoever ye turn, there shineth my light. One in my essence, in all things I am seen. Hath ever aught been seen but me? The veil of creation I have made is a screen for the truth, and in creation there lie secrets which suddenly like springs gush forth. Whoso is ignorant of my essence beneath my veil, he asketh where I am, say am, without where. For in my being is no gap, as from one where to another. Confer but the point of the zane on the rein, and behold it. The stain is an ornament perfect in virtue of the point. Come then unto union with the Eternal. Is there aught beside him to oppose him? Nay, he alone was, is, and shall be. I then am absolute in essence, infinite. My only where is through myself I am. Ignorance to know me, either here or there. The above all above is not bounded by any top. The beneath all beneath hath no nethermost depth. I am the secret of the essence, treasure inscrutable. No end to my breadth, no end to my length. I, in the inward hiddenness, was manifest air. It outwardly showed, I asked myself of myself, and a pure positive was the answer. For can other than God appear in God's truth? He struck terror, then inclined. He overwhelmed and then spake. I am essentially one, single, unencroachable, by the least object. Leave I any crevice and space vacant that to another might go? For the inside am I of the essence in itself, and the outside of the quality diffuse concentration. Thither is there none whither I am not turning, doth other than me exist? Empty of my attribute? My essence is the essence of being, now, always. My infinity is not limited by the least grain of mustard. Where can the creature find room to intrude on the truth's infinite? Where other than it, when all is full? Union and separation are thus in principle the same. And to behold creation is to behold the truth. If creation be interpreted as it truly is, interpret then all in the light of He is near, and thou thyself of that nearness shall partake. Deem not this localization, that were impossible, for He cometh not to dwell in any place. Extol the essence of God above the touch of other than it. It is borne by none, beneath no burden. It is hidden in its own outward manifestation, wherein it doth appear as veil after veil, made to cover its glory. The following selection from Sharafuddin Munari's The Hundred Letters gives expression to this week's traditional reading. It is Letter 24, The Fundamentals of the Way, and is translated by Paul Jackson. Brother Shamsuddin, may God help you attain the object of your desires. The fundamentals of the way are set forth in this tradition, quote, "My servant is diligent in approaching me through supererogatory prayers till I love him. And when I love him, I become the ear by which he hears, the eye by which he sees, the hand by which he holds, and the tongue by which he speaks." End of quote. When God holds someone in special affection, God behaves towards him in the same way as a kindly mother does with her small son. She is ever on the alert for whatever might harm him. She is careful to attend to all his needs without his having to say anything about them. In truth, it should be known that when God Almighty looks with favor on someone, he turns him into a focal point for the needs of the people. The dust trodden under his feet becomes a soothing ointment for the eyes and a fragrant scent for travelers on the way. There is a story that the people of Basra had come out of the city to beseech God for rain. Their prayers and lamentations produced not a drop of rain. Then a traveler happened to pass by. He saw the large crowd with upraised hands, closed eyes, and mournful voices. A sense of empathy arose within him. Quote, "O God Almighty, by the secret which is in my eyes, send rain," end of quote, he prayed. Immediately it began to rain. When someone from the crowd heard what he had said and saw what he had done and noted that his prayer had been answered instantaneously, he followed the traveler to his house and said, quote, "O Sheikh, I have a request to make of you." "Tell me," he replied. "What is that secret in your eyes," he asked, "which made them able to offer an intercession resulting in rain?" End of quote. Quote, "These eyes of mine," he replied, "have seen Bayezid. You should know that the dust he treads upon becomes a collyrium for the eyes. His tongue also is like spring rain, producing life. Just as spring rain clothes the dead earth with a vesture of new life and turns a thorn-infested tract into a rose garden, so a word from the lips of Bayezid can bring back to life the dead hearts of men," end of quote. And he spoke in such a way that his words came straight from the heart, because his deeds and qualities had been united, his mercy and kindness could shine upon all. He was the sort of man who himself does not eat, but feeds others, who wears little himself, but clothes others. Nor does he pay attention to the wounds inflicted by others. Where there is oppression, he brings trust. He opposes abuse with prayer to God and praise of Him. Do you know the reason for all this? It is because He is protected. Nothing except gentle breezes waft across the plain of His heart towards others. His compassion is like the sun, which shines equally on friend or foe. His humility is like the earth, upon the face of which all creatures tread. He takes in hand no lawsuit against another. No one could even talk of his anger towards his fellow man. All are his dependents, though he is beholden to no one. His bounty is like a river. He blesses his enemy, concentrating all his mercy upon his foe. Most men, though free, see everything from one viewpoint, but his outlook is universal. He accords everyone equal treatment. A person who does not partake all this quality should not take a single step on the way. He would be a seeker after money and fame, and the speech he uttered would be of no avail, for whenever God Almighty raises up someone, he raises him up completely, so he gives him a tongue and hands and eyes and ears and a pure heart. Unfortunately, you and I know orators whose very tongues and hands bear witness against them, as indeed do all their members. They cannot retrieve a morsel they have already placed in their mouth, and yet they cannot remove the Sufi garb from themselves. Their desire is that the world should acknowledge that it is beholden to them, and that the Friday prayer should be read in their name to their own advantage. A man who throughout his life is unwilling to go into the bazaar wearing a sash or a simple vest or an ordinary hat because he fears being disgraced in the sight of the tailor, appears to a perceptive person as a worshipper of self rather than a worshipper of God. By the same token, a man who sits in a hermitage and adorns himself with prestige and self-seclusion so that people might consider him a man of probity and pay attention to him is acting like a woman of ill repute who spends the whole day adorning herself in order to attract the glances of men. It is fitting that all a man's members should become tongues and that his tongue should support his heart, but it should be cut out with the sword of modesty if it ever wants to speak anything but the truth concerning God. His heart also should become a mirror reflecting in front of him whatever has happened in his past, so that he feels tongue-tied. He is unable to say what he wanted to say, and he murmurs, "Such a tongue is unable to make a single statement about God," and from that moment he ceases to talk. It has been said that everyone who comes out of his own home knows the way back, so that, if need be, he can return home. The speech of such a person is not fully grounded in the way. For a Sufi, the heart takes precedence over the tongue, while for a scholar, it is the tongue that has precedence over the heart. A Sufi is impelled to action by his heart. Orators, however, and those who pursue this world of ours are going along with staves. What are they doing? They are blind, for like a blind person, each uses his tongue like a staff, striking the ground here and there as he goes along. In this way, he shows that he is a blind man. In some, Sufis put their trust in their heart rather than in their tongue. Do you not see that if what outwardly seems to be infidelity springs from the fullness of a person's heart, it is in fact genuine faith? Quote, "For he who has been compelled to recant while his heart remains faithful," end of quote, and this is from the Quran, "is still a believer. By the same token, the faith that proceeds from an evil heart is really a form of impiety. As God declared, quote, "These people say, 'We bear witness that you are the messenger of God,'" end of quote. And God knows that you are indeed his messenger, and God bears witness that the hypocrites are inveterate liars, end of quote. And this is from the Quran. The tongue is the master of the household of the law. Command and prohibition become known through it, and religion is proclaimed by it. When someone becomes dedicated to God's work, then the tongue becomes something good. Do you not see that it was the nightingale of the rose garden of the law who said, quote, "I am the most eloquent among Arabs and non-Arabs," end of quote. And yet, at the end of his work, even he exclaimed, quote, "I cannot calculate the praise that is due you," end of quote. Such was the extent of the prophet's astonishment. O brother, why should the person who displays eloquence in the stage of thinking God hesitate in the stage of unity? A dear friend has offered the following explanation, quote, "In love, the best way to proceed is to remember that you have erred. No wonder that in praising and glorifying you, even the most eloquent speaker of both worlds was dumbstruck," end of quote. Normally, a person talks continuously about something he likes very much. But in the design of love, it is only when a person steps beyond conversation and then returns to the world that he reaches him. Quote, the beauty of those who are furthest from God are loudest in the remembrance of him, end of quote. Appears to him, quote, if I were wise, I would talk less about you. I would close the path of conversation. I would gather together a few scorched hearts, and then I would weep over my talking and lament it, end of quote. O brother, a man who has become a full-fledged believer is very precious indeed, but most people simply put their hands into the throat of faith and move them around a bit. Not everyone who reaches the king's door finds admission to his presence. Quote, surely the idolaters are unclean, end of quote, and this is from the Quran. Purity of heart is a condition for admission. In hell there will be many thousands of tongues that call upon God, but not one heart that knows him. You will see many thousands of eloquent tongues that have become mute, but you will not find a single heart in the clutches of the guardians of hell. O brother, you might not have this rich crown upon your head at the moment, but this is no reason to brand your heart with hopelessness. The Quran attests, quote, God does not impose on any soul more than it can bear, end of quote. The weight of the commands given to each is in accordance with his or her strength. If our heads are empty of any crown while our hearts bear the mark of hopelessness, these misfortunes are separate and at least not compounded. If there is no step which befits religion, then let us turn to shouting slogans by groups of ten saying, quote, no one would purchase people with afflictions like those whom God purchases. Who else would pay the price for you that he does? End of quote. As the poet has observed, quote, behold us, full of faults, and you the buyer. How shoddy the goods, but how generous the buyer. End of quote. It has been said, quote, if you turn to a sanctuary in your old age, I shall put every kingdom at your disposal. But if you follow my instructions during your youth, I shall make a way for you in the midst of the angels. Just as you know my right to command and prohibit, so too realize that your justification is dependent on my own generosity. I do not in any way hold the breaking of your promise against you. If you have been afflicted with any grief, I would wish to apologize again for it on my own behalf. End of quote. I shall tell you the secret of all that you have heard. God speaks out of his own generosity. It is impossible for his truth and generosity to have limits. If all the renegades and devilish people of the world, together with their offspring and dependents, were to be exalted to the utmost, and the eternal kingly crown were to be placed on their heads, still God's truth and generosity would barely have been tapped. Peace. writing of one kind or another has been bubbling to the surface of my consciousness since the mid-1960s, when I was attending university as an undergraduate. However, it was not until being permitted to step onto the Sufi path in 1972 that the writing process began in earnest for me, first in the service of my sheikh in conjunction with various community projects in which he was involved, and then later on, after he had passed away in 1988, in conjunction with various books and poems that, by the grace of God, were somehow brought into material being. All of the latter writings were from a Sufi perspective. However, the vocabulary of those writings did not always assume a traditional character. In other words, on the surface, such writings might have seemed to be secular in nature, discussing such topics as physics, evolution, cosmology, political science, history, legal philosophy, education, economics, psychology, and the like. Nonetheless, those discussions were always informed by and rooted in a Sufi spiritual perspective. The language of truth need not be restricted to the vocabulary of theology. God's truths are capable of being expressed through loci of manifestation of many colors, forms, properties, and styles. To date, and by the grace of God, 33 books, 39 pieces of floetry, and a few videos have been issued through me. The topics are extremely varied, but they give expression to the principles, values, and ideas that I have learned while traveling along the Sufi path. The foregoing body of work is not intended to constitute a compilation of the writings of a Sufi teacher or spiritual guide. Instead, they are intended as the fallible offerings of a person who has been seeking the truth for much of his life and wishes to share such findings, tentative though they might be, with others who might find some value in them. If you are interested in learning how to acquire a software package containing 33 books, 39 pieces of floetry, and 4 videos exploring different dimensions of Islam, the Sufi path, and reality in general, for the very low price of $19.95, then please go to anab-whitehouse.com. I believe the Sufi Reflection software package encompasses a unique set of writings that encompasses a great deal of food for thought on a variety of issues. Although I do not have the talent or spiritual stature of Rumi, Hafiz, or even my own spiritual guide, may God be pleased with them all, nevertheless, from time to time, the impetus to write poetry has arisen within me. I have joined such efforts to various musical backgrounds, produced a combination of rhythm, rhyme, and musical overtones that I refer to as floetry, which, in a way, sort of harkens back to the beat generation of the late 1940s and early 1950s, when individuals would recite their poetical compositions against the backdrop of the improvised offerings of a group of jazz musicians that shared the stage with the poet. Some of the poems that will appear in this section of the Sufi Study Circle podcast are inspired by life events of my own, while other poems are rooted in the teachings of great spiritual luminaries of the past. In the latter case, I have run someone else's understanding through the filters of my own limitations, but have tried as best I can to retain the spirit of the ideas and sensibilities that were given expression through the original poems or prose of some great Sufi of the past. The following piece of floetry seeks to give poetical expression to a few of the teachings of the Sufi saint Hazrat Ata'illah. May Allah be pleased with him. Some think that attainment of spiritual height is accomplished through personal excellence, but efforts will not permit one to gain sight of the sun or save one from the pestilence of ego that creates a solar eclipse. Don't look to yourself, but seek divinity. And do not go down that path asking favors, but incline only towards the serenity of worship, so that you might one day savor treasures flowing through one's essential nature. If the one wants you to realize divine presence, God will clothe your empty quality with names and attributes that are royal signs bestowed at divine discretion on lowly wards according to the purposes of essence. What comes from the peasant is relatively unimportant, though it has its rightful place. What is both sufficient and necessary is that which comes to being through divine grace. So become like the dead and let yourself go. Be a proper guest and permit your great host to show how things work in the lay of the land. This will enable you to derive the most benefit from what you're told, to understand that patient focus is the key to the soul's growth. Don't be disappointed if gifts are delayed. Let the giver determine when and where to deliver artful blessings that have been made just for you, and take what is given to do good works that show heartfelt appreciation. We flee from divinity both night and day, failing to see there is no separation from the one who oversees the passion play, where actors are locked in anticipation of a curtain call that is hidden from them. When we receive, the hand of benevolence comes into our lives, and when God withholds, then arms of constraint encircle us like a fence. Divine qualities shape our way and all send us in directions that contain life lessons. Prayer is the elixir that removes all stain and guides us down the path to intimacy. Prayer is woven from a mystery whose main substance is faith in the reciprocity of lovers who are content with their station. Within, there are seeds of possibility that must be buried in a nurturing earth, which, despite its apparent obscurity, is the place from which fruits of divine worth are grown through the gardener's merciful work. Do not long for contraction or expansion. Let your entreaty be for perfect slavery. The only intention should be to serve none but your Lord, and to express your sovereignty through observing the states and stations of truth. When the light of Zikr truly starts to burn, it ruins the temple of worship within. As it consumes all, one will come to discern. It's the fire that takes away the night's sin. It is the bright lantern that leads one aright. Today's edition of Meditative Essays is entitled Beliefs. Beliefs are a double-edged sword. On the one hand, they may provide a heuristic framework through which to explore experience and derive meaning and value from those aspects of reality with which we interact. On the other hand, beliefs also have the capacity to place limits on the kind of meaning and value we can generate as a function of experience. Thus, beliefs simultaneously establish degrees of freedom as well as impose constraints. For example, if one believes in atheism, the structure of this belief provides one with a spectrum of possibilities, i.e. degrees of freedom, with respect to how one might derive meaning and value from experience. However, at the same time, the nature of the character of this belief in atheism prevents one, in other words, places constraints on one, from seriously entertaining any idea involving claims that God is, in any sense, real. The structure of any belief gives expression to a set of parameters which establish what is, for that belief, either permissible or impermissible. Such parameters of permissibility provide one with a framework for determining whether and in what way other beliefs are compatible or inconsistent with such a belief. Science, history, theology, and philosophy each have their own unique way of creating, exploring, questioning, linking, and evaluating different beliefs. In each instance, the beliefs being discussed give expression to both degrees of freedom and limitations. Furthermore, while beliefs have the potential to help us to make some sort of contact with reality, beliefs can just as easily distance us from the truth of things. We all face the difficult, complex task of trying to differentiate those beliefs which tell us something important and hopefully true about the nature of reality from those beliefs which merely obfuscate matters and place obstacles in our way. The fact we believe something to be the case does not make it so. In addition, just because we may have a feeling of certainty associated with a given belief, this does not necessarily constitute proof such a belief is true. Alternatively, the mere existence of doubts or reservations in relation to a given belief does not automatically mean the belief is not true. Beliefs saturate our conceptual life. We have beliefs about who we are, and we have beliefs about whether or not life ultimately has any purpose. We have beliefs about what values we ought to have, and we have beliefs about how one goes about proving something. We have beliefs about origins, and we have beliefs about ends. Beliefs color the intentions and motivations through which we engage ourselves, others, and the universe. Beliefs shape our attitudes. Beliefs mediate between us and the world. We are attracted to some beliefs and not others. Sometimes this attraction is a matter of the way in which a belief seems to reflect our own experience and helps to organize such experience in a useful way. Sometimes we are drawn to certain beliefs because they are capable of seducing us by exploiting various needs, desires, and/or weaknesses we have. Sometimes beliefs become influential in our lives because of the manner in which they address our fears or anxieties or hopes. Sometimes beliefs have an ascetic appeal for us, and we fall under the spell of their beauty. Sometimes a belief appeals to us because it is compatible with our temperament or personality. Sometimes a belief attracts us because it seems to confer a sense of uniqueness on us, which helps set us apart as being superior to or better than other people. Examining the roots of our beliefs can be a valuable exercise. On the other hand, this can be a profoundly disturbing undertaking as well. We tend to believe that we believe what we do because those beliefs are in some sense true. We feel our beliefs accurately reflect more or less the way things are in reality. Consequently, if we should discover we believe what we do not because it expresses the truth, but because the belief suits our personality or temperament or needs or fears or hopes or other vested interests, then suddenly our whole world is thrown into turmoil and confusion. This is so because we no longer are who we believe ourselves to be. This is so because we must now reevaluate our whole relationship with existence. We need to do this because up until now, the nature of our relationship with existence has been mediated by a set of beliefs that no longer mean what we believed heretofore to be the case. Even if the belief or beliefs in question is or are true, as long as our motivations for holding them are due to something besides the purported truth of those ideas, there are problems that emerge. These problems revolve around issues of integrity, sincerity, honesty, purpose, intention, and identity. We have many kinds of belief about God. These beliefs may be true or they may not be true, or perhaps some aspects of the beliefs may be true while other aspects of such beliefs may be false. Furthermore, we have many reasons, other than matters of purported truth, for holding on to such beliefs. There are psychological reasons for believing. There are social, economic, and political reasons for believing. There are philosophical reasons for believing. There are theological reasons for believing. There are emotional reasons for believing. And there are personal and experiential reasons for believing. All of these reasons for holding different kinds of belief concerning the nature of God often involve advantages or benefits to be gained by believing God exists. Moreover, the reasons for believing also presupposes God exists. If this were not the case, then our various reasons for believing would be arguing from nowhere to nowhere. The Sufi masters maintain we must rid ourselves of our thoughts of advantage, benefits, and vested interests when we approach God. The beliefs we have concerning God should be pure in intention, and therefore they should be devoid of all expectations for any kind of return on our beliefs. The beliefs we have should be rooted in an unconditional submission. The practitioners of the Sufi path proclaim that God's love for all of us is unconditional. Thus, God's love does not depend on whether we believe or do not believe in divinity. Furthermore, such love is not predicated on our belief having a certain structural form. From the Sufi perspective, unconditional love calls out for unconditional love. If our beliefs are entangled in reasons, advantages, and benefits, then such benefits are not rooted in the pure intentionality of unconditional love. On the Sufi path, considerable attention is devoted to the purification of the intentions associated with our beliefs. Under the watchful and knowing eye of the spiritual teacher, we must examine very carefully and very critically the character of our intention with respect to God. If our intention is colored by hopes, fears, desires, anxieties, expectations, and so on, then we are seeking something besides God. Nothing but God should be the focus of our intentions. The Sufi masters carry the matter one substantial step further. Ultimately, one should not approach God through beliefs but through divinity, for beliefs constitute a modality of separation between the seeker and the sought. Therefore, at a certain point along the Sufi path, the reality to which beliefs allude must be experienced directly. Beliefs qua beliefs must fall away. Today's edition of It Has Been Said is as follows. What is worship? It is to realize reality. The following segment of the Sufi Study Circle podcast is a brief prayer that is offered on behalf of whomever might have managed to survive to this portion of the program. O Allah, let us give up doubt in favor of belief. Let us give up hypocrisy in favor of sincerity. Let us give up worldliness in favor of asceticism. Let us give up pride in favor of humility. And, O our Lord, let us give up enmity in favor of love. This week's edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast has been brought to you by the Interrogative Imperative Institute, where the process of asking questions becomes an artful journey to solutions for life. You have been listening to the Sufi Study Circle podcast. The host for this program, namely yours truly, is neither a sheikh nor a spiritual guide, nor am I equipped to advise anyone where she or he might be able to formally step onto the Sufi path. When I stumbled into the spiritual tavern of my sheikh, I had no idea what I was doing or how I had found such an establishment. When my sheikh passed away, there were no provisions left in place for anyone else to assume his responsibilities in the future. Since his passing away, I have come to learn, in a very close-up and problematic way, that there are spiritual charlatans who are constantly trolling the waters of existence for vulnerable prey. While I believe there still are authentic spiritual guides who exist in various parts of the world, and unfortunately are becoming fewer in number, I do not have confidence in recommending this or that person as being an authentic sheikh, which is not to say that such people aren't legitimate, but rather it is to say that I do not feel comfortable in recommending them to anyone as individuals for whom I could give assurances that they are people on whom one can rely spiritually. The contents of the program are intended merely as food for thought. While such food might induce someone to want to journey beyond the very limited horizons of the podcast, please keep in mind that I am of the understanding that the Sufi path cannot be traversed without an authentic spiritual guide. And unfortunately, as indicated previously, there are many fraudulent teachers who are actively seeking opportunities to misguide people and thereby not only muddying the spiritual waters, but attempting to corrupt, if not destroy, the spiritual potential of unsuspecting people. Information concerning past editions of the Sufi Study Circle can be found by going to anab-whitehouse.com/circle, that's capital C, small I-R-C-L-E .htm. Thank you for your time, and perhaps we will convene again in the future during some further, God willing, edition of the Sufi Study Circle podcast.